Today is a welcome and introductions by staff. And so, actually, I'll start with our safety briefing.
All right. Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. This morning I have a new evacuation route, so please listen carefully. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the doors in the back of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash, so please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the doors in the back of the room. In the event of any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out the building using the doors in the back of the room, down the hallway, through the cafeteria, towards the grassy area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies. Time now to turn off any noise-making devices. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Now I'd like to have the board members and staff please go ahead and introduce themselves. I'm Bridget Moran, Department of Natural Resources, designee for the Commissioner of Public Lands. Tom, why don't we start with you?
Good morning. I'm Tom Davis, Director's designee for the State Department of Agriculture.
Norm Schaaf, General Public Member.
Good morning, everyone. Tom Laurie, Director's designee for Department of Ecology.
I'm Mark Calhoun, representing the Department of Commerce.
Good morning, Anna Jackson, Director's Designee for Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good morning, I'm Dave Herrera, General Public Member.
Doug Stinson, General Public Member, Small Forest Landowner.
Bill Little, I represent the Timber Unions.
Great, thank you. And staff?
Trish Anderson, Rules Coordinator for the Board.
Shane Martinez, Forest Practice Division. Mark Gingell, Forest Practices Assistant
Division Manager. Bill Ferrister, Assistant Attorney General, Counsel of the Board.
Aaron Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager.
Great. Thank you. And I know we have some additional DNR staff in the room, and they will introduce themselves when they come up to present items in front of the board. Our first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from our August 9th board meeting. I know that there are a few amendments to those. I have one myself. Why don't I go ahead and start, since I think mine's a little shorter and easier. Mine is on page 11, on line 9, and it's in the road maintenance and abandonment planning, RMAP rulemaking section. And I'd like to add the phrase, based on recommendations made during the public comment period, so it would read as such. He said, in addition to the proposed language before the board, comma, based on recommendations made during the public comment period, comma, that's the addition, DNR recommends changing the word completion date to October 31st instead of July 1st so landowners can take advantage of a full construction season before the deadline. And my reason for including that is because that is how we heard about that requested change to the season for RMAPs, and we wanted that reflected in the record because that was the rationale for changing the rule. So again, it would be an insertion of based on recommendations made during the public comment period. Okay, any questions on that from other board members? Okay. And I know Tom has a little lengthy.
Okay, thank you. My change is on page 10, and it's testimony from Stephen Bernath. And it's his stuff starts at line 19. And after that first sentence, you would strike everything, and then I'll read the corrected version. This just has to do with clarifying what the Clean Water Act assurance milestones are relative to the RMAP program. Oh, it's on the board there. You can all see it. It's, I won't read it. Thank you. So it just clarifies the relationship between the milestones and RMAPs.
Tom, on line 31,
there's a
typo or an inserted word, the word small at the, towards the end of the sentence there.
Right where your cursor is, that's a duplication.
Oh, it says small, the status?
Yeah.
Stephen, what were you thinking when you said that?
Every time we edit it.
So just eliminating the word small. Thank you very much.
Right. Any particular questions on that change? Okay, if none, entertain a motion regarding the minutes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We also have to address the issue of redlining.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Council, to the board. I'd like to mention that when the minutes were sent out this last time, they included redline strikeouts, which was an error on our part. Typically, we accept all of the edits as they come through our process, and then the final minutes go out without a red line strikeout. There were places in the notes that, through clarification, we made some edits, and those were reflected in red strikeout. And so the final minutes would be an acceptance of all of the red line strikeout, and they were as depicted in the minutes that were sent out, but they would be finalized without the red line strikeout. Any concerns or questions regarding that? In the future, we will not do that. Sorry for the confusion.
Did you have a motion?
Yes, there is a motion.
Oh, I'll move we accept the board minutes of tonight, as presented today.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor of the adoption of the minutes as presented today, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say no. Approved. That's unanimous. Thank you. Okay, now I'd like to move on to the agenda with the report from the chair. And I have a few items to discuss this morning. First and foremost, I wanted to thank the board members that, at least officially today, it's their last board meeting. Doug Stinson, today is technically Doug's last board meeting, and Sherry Fox, who is ill. She may make the meeting today, but we don't know at this point. She is not here, and we understand that she is going to try to be here by this afternoon. But both Doug and Sherry, their terms expire at the end of this year. And so I know the governor's office is working on new appointments. And so I want to thank you for your service. It's been quite some time that both you and Sherry have been on the board, and we really appreciate your engagement with the board and your participation. It's been a great learning experience for me personally, and I want to thank you for that. I'd also like to remind you that until a replacement is actually appointed, that by tradition and by statute, you are asked to continue to serve. And the board staff always remind me to remind you of that. So I am, and that takes me into just a broader conversation about board replacement. Carolyn Dobbs' position has been vacant for some time, and I've been working with the governor's office on a replacement. And I think many of you know that John Mankowski had been the governor's staffer who addressed many of the forestry issues, and John left the governor's office, and now Bob Nichols has taken his place, has rejoined the governor's office, and is familiar with our issues, but is coming up to speed still on some of those topics. And so Bob and I have had conversations about the appointments. I let him know that that's a very high priority for DNR to get the board back to its full capacity, and so I'm actively working on that with him. And I know both Doug and Sherry's have submitted names as well for their replacement, so there are people in the queue, and it's just a matter of working through the process with the governor's office. So I will continue to bird dog that one. But again, thank you, Doug. Appreciate the perspective you brought to the board all these years. Okay, another item I wanted to just mention is that at the last board meeting, we had a request for a greater opportunity for public comment. There were times when the board got so far ahead of its agenda that individuals who showed up well in advance of their time to provide testimony to the board didn't get that opportunity because the board got so far ahead of schedule. So we're going to try something a little different today. We have both a morning and afternoon public comment period that's set aside for items that are not action items. And so it's a bit of an experiment. So we'll try that. We'll see how that works. The intent is just to provide opportunity for members of the public that to provide testimony to the board in a way that is as transparent and facilitates that conversation with the board as possible. So we'll see how that works today. I would welcome feedback from board members on that. There are multiple different ways we could go with that. We can have one public comment period. That we can have two, as we have today. We have public comment prior to every action item, and so I would welcome feedback on that. We can maybe at the end of the day discuss just briefly how we thought the public comment structure is, because I want to make sure that board members are okay with the change. So, or propose something alternative. Either way, we're good. Trying to make public comment as easy as possible. Another item is that when we passed the FREP legislation, the FREP reform bill last year, there was an item in there that required the chair of the board to convene a committee to identify a permanent funding source for FREP. And I'm pleased to announce that we'll be commencing that that committee here shortly. There will be an executive management appointee within DNR who will be chairing that. I don't have exactly who that is yet, whether it's me or a designee to do that, but I can tell you it will be somebody from our executive management team, and we look forward to a robust debate, and we'll be in contact with folks for participating in that. The legislation requires a reporting back to the legislature by May 31st of 2012 with proposals for permanent funding for the FREP program. So anybody who has an interest in participating in that, please come talk with me. I assume that that will be a multi-caucus discussion, but if anybody has a particular interest that to participate, please come talk to me. So we'll be commencing that shortly. I think everybody knows that the legislature will be back in town after Thanksgiving. The governor's budget is expected to come out on November 21st, right before Thanksgiving, and then legislature convenes November 28th. And so we are expecting a fairly busy time period for us. And so just wanted to make sure all of our stakeholders were aware that that season is coming upon us again. And work with us in that time when the program is heavily taxed. And then finally, I wanted to share a topic that has been the high area of interest for all of us for some time, which is sustainable funding for the Forest Practices Program and the Adaptive Management Program in particular. The Commissioner of Public Lands, Peter Goldmark, and Director of Ecology, Ted Sturtevant, have been discussing different ways that we can address the Forest Practices Adaptive Management Program predicted shortfalls. I think most of you have heard about the concerns for the Adaptive Management Program. It's on a steady trajectory towards depleting all of its resources. We have completely expended all of the federal seed money that has been granted to the state as startup dollars for the Adaptive Management Program, and we are now at a point where We are spending down our resources with our list of studies that remains strong. And so we have a long-term sustainable funding problem that we've been trying to address. You've heard about this likely over the last few years since the Forest and Fish Policy Group has put funding for adaptive management on its work list. But now the Commissioner and Director Sturdivant have recognized the great threats to the program for the lack of funding and have taken the initiative to convene a variety of individuals, many of the caucus principals, not all, in a conversation to address the shortfalls in the adaptive management program. In so doing, we convened, we developed a plan in conjunction with the Department of Ecology, a four-point plan that would both attempt to reform the adaptive management program. I think many of you around this table have heard about the structural and procedural challenges we have with our adaptive management program in addition to the funding shortfalls. The four-point plan includes a short-term look at the existing process through a lean analysis. That's a type of external analysis that's done on a process to find a way to more effectively and efficiently proceed through whatever type of process it is, whether it's a regulatory process or a private entity, a private business process improvement type of approach. And you're going to hear more about that later today. But there, so part one of the plan is to take a quick look now at how we're doing business within the adaptive management program. I think folks remember that the state auditor was planning on auditing our adaptive management program at our request, and they have subsequently deleted the adaptive management audit from their work plan. That item has been, those audits were line items out of their budget, and consequently, the adaptive management program audit was line items off their list of things to do. So our proposal includes step one, which is a immediate look at the existing structure and process for adaptive management. Part two of the plan includes a commissioner and director-led process to take the findings from the lean process and convene a multi-stakeholder conversation to evaluate whether there are actual structural changes needed for the adaptive management program. So the lean process looks at the existing process as it is and finds that there are efficiencies that can be had within your existing process. We want to take that information and then, in addition, look at the entire structural program and see if there are some necessary changes. In addition to that, part three of the plan would be to redirect some of the existing fund balance that's in the Forest and Fish support account. We have had a bump in revenue flowing into the support account, and we'd like to ask the legislature to increase the appropriation so that we can reinvest in meeting some of our Clean Water Act milestones. We, as you've heard at our recent meetings, we've had a number of concerns about our ability to meet our Clean Water Act milestones. We'd like to have the opportunity in the short run to reinvest in some of those critical areas, and we'll talk more about that a little later. And then finally, the last part of the plan would be to find a more long-term, stable funding source for the program in general. We have a number of ideas. They are all fraught with troubles, frankly. If it was easy, it would have been done by now. But there are a variety of ideas, some of which includes redirecting the existing fees into the support account, some of which includes redirecting the forest harvest excise tax, the state portion of which, into the support account and using those funds to fund the adaptive management program. However, none of those are easy. Those funds currently go to the general fund, and we're not even contemplating that until the 2015-17 biennium. But those are just some of the ideas. But the fourth point in the plan, nonetheless, is to establish a more permanent, long-term, sustainable funding piece. So there's been, DNR has been, and DNR and Ecology have been partnering with, to go around and meet with all the caucuses to talk about the different ideas. We've been soliciting different ideas from individuals and trying to coalesce them into a plan that would put us on a trajectory towards sustainability for the program. So we're going to have more of a conversation about this at the end of the day, but I wanted to give folks an idea about what the plan is and just start the conversation, because we at DNR are fairly concerned about our ability to meet our obligations on the trajectory we're on right now, and we know that we need to do something for the long term to get us back into a sustainable approach. Okay. Any questions on that before we move on to other items on the agenda? Okay. With that, let us move on to our first public comment period. And okay, we have 8 members of the public who have signed up to provide comment this morning, and I will ask that you keep your comments brief. And first person this morning is Vic Musselman.
Members of the board and Madam Chairman, I am Vic Musselman. I am WFFA Policy Chair. I'm also appearing before you today primarily in the role as a small woodland owner from Pacific County. Put my glasses on so I can read my testimony, and then I won't make any miscues. As you may or may not be aware of, this afternoon you're going to be hearing about an item on the agenda titled the Low Impact Riparian Thinning Template. Now, we have heard many names of this, so I don't know exactly what the true name of it is, but a horse by any other color is still a horse, and this is being presented by the staff of the DNR for adoption by you without the support of the WFFA and small forest land owners in general, and without consensus at Forest and Fish Policy. As a matter of fact, the first time the small forest landowners even heard about this template being presented today was when the agenda was published for your meeting over a month ago. It is my understanding that the process established under Forest and Fish Policy calls for all decisions to be made by consensus, which is the democratic way to produce results. We all believe in it. It is a workable method. Therefore, I urge you, the Forest Practices Board, not to adopt this template in any autocratic way without the backing of this consensus. Thank you for your time and for listening for me.
Thank you, Vic. Next, we have Carl Whitaker. Morning, Carl.
Morning, Chair Moran and board members. My name is Carl Whitaker. I'm the staff scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center. And I'd like to briefly comment on a few wildlife-related topics on today's agenda. First, the Conservation Caucus is pleased with the recent progress that has been made by the Northern Spotted Owl implementation team. We're especially encouraged by the hiring of dedicated staff to support the implementation team and the formation of a technical team that will use best available science and the Fish and Wildlife Service modeling framework to identify the non-federal lands that can make the strongest contributions to spotted owl conservation. Our caucus also supports the designation of a board subcommittee to form a strategy for addressing the recommendations of the federal spotted owl revised recovery plan on non-federal lands. Second, our caucus is happy to see DFW's upland wildlife update regarding marbled murrelets on today's agenda as well. I was a participant in the recent Fish and Wildlife Service stakeholder workshop on actions needed to halt the murrelet's continuing population decline. This workshop yielded a broad range of innovative ideas for addressing the complex set of threats faced by murrelets. Our caucus looks forward to DFW's briefing and the board discussion on this topic at the next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Next is David Robbins.
Good morning. Dave Robbins, Small tree farmer on the Olympic Peninsula, land that's been in our family for 100 years. And I've worked the land all my 60 years. I have no specific comment about anything on today's agenda other than a small description of what we go through as tree farmers. And I'll just tell you briefly, the first 20 years of my life on a tree farm were very good, but beginning in the early 70s, a number of federal laws seemingly spawned out an absolute blizzard of RCWs and WACs and endless issues that I've had for the last 4 years. I've had to learn how to farm with one hand and fend off the government with the other. And when I come to Olympia, I honestly feel like I'm entering a den of thieves. I would like to get into a specific discussion about something like, say, that has affected our valley, like the channel migration zone issues, but I understand you're on a pretty limited timeline, and I don't even know what's on today's agenda. I have no specific comments about today's agenda.
Well, thank you for traveling to make your comments before us.
And I suppose I could put something in writing if I wanted to explain how some of the laws just don't always translate well when they get onto the land. And that was the point I wanted to make about channel migration zones.
Yes, please do. Patricia will share her contact information, or you can submit that directly to the board, and that she will share that with all of us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Jim Peters. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm Jim Peters. I'm representing the Squaxin Island Tribal Council this morning. It's always an honor and pleasure to come and speak in front of this body. I'm going to be making some comments on a letter you received, and I don't know if it's going to be testimony later on for today, by Ken Miller, Mr. Ken Miller. I debated if I was going to bring this up or not today, but I decided to go ahead and go forward with it. In Mr. Miller's letter, he compares the small landowners to tribes. And although we might have some similarities on how we look at things, we're not the same. Tribes are sovereign governments with jurisdiction and authority to manage our treaty resources within the ceded lands that we ceded to the federal government. Mr. Miller goes on to try to compare the HCP and the Forest and Fish report as a treaty, which you may or may not know, only treaties can be negotiated between sovereign governments. The Forest and Fish and the HCP, like I said, is not a treaty. It is a management tool to try to help state and private forested landowners to manage and implement the Endangered Species Act. And so the Squaxin Island Tribal Council takes its Medicine Creek Treaty very serious with the federal government, and that the federal government recognizes those treaties as the law of the land. And I just wanted to make sure that I'd have this opportunity so that in that letter that you don't start to compare an HCP or a plan to manage natural resources out here as a treaty, because that treaty is pretty serious to the tribes, and we take that very seriously ourselves. I want to thank you for your time today, and if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Any questions? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Peter Goldman. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Chair Moran, members of the board. I'm Peter Goldman of the Washington Forest Law Center. I'm representing the Conservation Caucus. I'm also the Conservation Caucus's representative on the Forest and Fish Policy Committee. I was not at the August meeting, and I'd like to congratulate Chair Moran for her appointment to the chair and thank her very much for her generally very open and positive relationship with the Conservation Caucus and with the Forest Practice Division under her leadership. And I hope I haven't gotten her into trouble by saying
There it goes.
I'd like to begin at the 30,000 foot level. This board meets not four times a year, but there are multiple ad hoc task forces, subcommittees, working groups, and the policy committee, of course, ranging from the Spotted Owl Implementation Group to Forest Biomass Working Group and whatnot. And I think that this is the only way to do forest practice rulemaking these days, is to delegate a lot of these things to subgroups and technical stakeholder groups. But I urge the board today that when it hears the presentations from staff on the progress of some of these committees, I urge the board to inquire about timelines and targets and maintain this board's control over these processes. I think in general these processes are going well. They're going slowly. There's a fair bit of give and take, but I urge this board not to delegate all of its responsibility over timelines and targets to these committees, and really ask presenters targets and timelines, and let's make sure that we're all moving on track. So I'd like to now spend a minute talking about an important discussion that's taking place at Forest and Fish Policy right now, and it pertains to water typing. As many of you know, water typing is key, absolutely key to protecting fish and their forest habitats. If you don't have the water type correctly, you don't have the buffer that protects the water and the fish and the aquatic resources and the amphibians, et cetera, and the temperature and sediment and all those things. I don't think I need to explain to you why it's so important. But it is a hugely, hugely difficult issue to administer on 9.3 million acres of forest land. So at the current time, there is water typing is going to be before this board again soon. The policy committee recently committed to addressing, wrestling with the water typing issue. And so just a quick walking through history, it's going to come back to this board soon. I think we're not going to restate what is in your board packet dated October 19th from the Department of Ecology. We agree with ecology statements in that studies that the Clean Water Act non-fish bearing stream studies are absolutely key and they need to be addressed. And when the CEMER studies progress through the process, they will be back in front of this board and will look at the non-stream buffers. But in the meantime, there's still unfinished business with the fish buffers, the actual fish buffers. As many of you know, in 2005, the original plan for doing water typing was basically shelved. The idea was to do an electronic model for the whole state and have the model predict where the fish habitat was and where the non-fish habitat was. But in 2005, this board, based on the recommendations of CEMER, abandoned that model and adopted an interim water typing rule that presumes fish in certain streams of certain width and gradient, but allows landowners to exclude that habitat through the use of an electronic protocol survey. The board never, however, adopted some of the rules, actually adopted rules that said that fish habitat are places where fish can go. We never got there. We're now in a system where fish are basically where they are, and we're eliminating habitat in a lot of places. So we're not in where we need to be. And very importantly, we're also not providing protection for places that are off-channel areas, and that is a result of the fact that we never adopted a permanent rule, and instead we are now continually distinguishing between type 2 and 3 waters. Now this is all really complicated, and I don't have the time to really go into it, and maybe staff will.
Thank you, I do need you to summarize.
Yeah, but the bottom line is that our caucus is bringing water typing back. For illustrative purposes only, our caucus submitted a potential rulemaking petition to policy to explain to policy what it is we think we could ask this board to do on water typing. I want to make it clear on the record, we're not filing a rulemaking petition today, but we had 12 copies made to share with you what it is that we've submitted to policy to show why this is important and why off-channel isn't being protected and why habitat isn't being protected. But this is an extremely important unfinished business that needs to get worked out. And I want to thank the agencies for and try everybody for realizing how important this is. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Oh, excuse me.
Sorry.
You said you made copies or data. Is that going to be available?
That's, for us? I'm going to give it to Tricia right now.
All right. Thank you.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Wyatt Golden.
I'm also the available, but I withdraw my comments.
Okay, thank you. Chris Mendoza. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Board. My name is Chris Mendoza. I'm a Conservation Caucus representative at CEMER. And before I start my comments, I'd like to make a slight correction. Based on Mr. Goldman's comments, he stated that CEMER made recommendations to the board concerning the fish habitat model, and it was policy that made recommendations to the board. CEMER's science results on validating that fish model went to policy along with some recommendations, but the policy petition what actually came here. He's still learning his way around.
Yeah.
So my comments have mainly to do with your early statement, Chair, concerning the OFM review of the adaptive management program that's not going to happen. And what I wanted to do is just take a moment to talk about the implications of that not happening. One of the benefits of having an independent review of any program is that it casts unbiased eyes on the program that it's looking at. CEMER recently went through an independent review of our monitoring program by Stillwater Sciences, and we've made some changes based on those recommendations, which hopefully will be summarized by the end of the year so we can get those posted. CEMER also uses, as you know, a blind review of our research studies through the University of Washington, so that we have independent scientists that don't have a vested interest in the outcome of our science and give us input. The risks inherent in conducting your own review of your own program is you have stakeholders involved that are looking internally at the process, some of which may be part of the problems that an independent review would capture. So as you move forward with this lean process and not knowing more about it or what it is exactly, I would caution the board and the agencies to watch out for that, any potential biases in streamlining a review that you are a part of. Thank you.
Thank you, and I would just correct you that it's not OFM that was going to do the audit, but the state auditor's office. But thank you. I will take it. And last person this morning is Jeffrey Thomas. Morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning. I'm Jeffrey Thomas, the director of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Program for the Puyallup Tribe. I wanted to make a comment or two about the notification to tribes involving the CR 102 rule language that has been approved for review by the public as a part of the overall code revisers process. My comment about that is that I've been anxiously awaiting some kind of formal notification to at least the Puyallup Tribal TFW program that the CR 102 language involving 222-20-120 notification of forest practices to affected Indian tribes was now out for formal comment. And nothing has really come to the attention of my program, and so I thought I would investigate that for just a little bit and see where the notifications may have gone to. And as I review my record, and I do keep a pretty thorough email record, I don't find any notification that has come forth from the Northwest Indian Fish Commission about the availability or about the circulation of the CR 102 rule proposal. Nor did I find anything that had come forth from Patricia Anderson, the Forest Practices Rules Coordinator, about the availability of that now being up for review. I am concerned that tribes may not have the word that the CR 102 language is now out for formal review, and given that they are the subject of the section and the ones that will benefit the most from review and comment pertaining to the section, that I'd like to ask the board that they reassure themselves and the other TFW stakeholders that in fact the tribes have gotten the notification that they would otherwise expect. It may be that it has gone out as a letter to the tribal chair that you hope is going to be routed to the necessary individuals that would have the interest of the tribe, but I'm not sure that's so because I haven't been able to put my finger on a letter that's gone out to tribal chairs. So I could just be uninformed and not looking in the right places. But I do, in my investigative efforts, I was able to find notification. I was able to find that on September 7th, the Forest Practices Board website for current rulemaking activity does display that the CR 102 procedures or posting or filing with the Code Revisor's Office occurred on September 7th, as of September 7th. And so I started looking for email communications out to the tribes that I would have received either through Patricia or the Northwest Indian Fish Commission TFW coordinator, informing our tribe that was in fact the case. And I did find something that had gone out from the Fish Commission on September 8th, which was a forward of a message they got from the DNR on September 8th, one that was entitled DNR Forest Practices Rulemaking Activity Update. In that update, I do see reference to the RMAP CR 103, the FREP CR 101, and the Critical Habitat CR 101, and that's all there is. So that we would have expected that the CR 102 for the Notice of Forest Practices to Affected Indian Tribes would have probably been, mentioned at that time. And then another one came in a week later, and that was the Notice to Review and Comment on the Forest Practices Rule Proposal for Critical Habitats that was entering into CR 101. That had come directly to us through Patricia Anderson, the rules coordinator, as well as Nancy Sturhan, the Fish Commission, the TFW coordinator. But after that, I just don't see anything in my record that indicates that there's been notice that's been sent out to tribes regarding notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes being now out for CR 102 review. So I just wanted to mention that and do what we could to reassure ourselves that, in fact, that's really happened the way it's expected to be.
Thank you for your comments, Jeffrey. I appreciate your comments. I will check with staff, but my understanding is that because the hearings for that weren't going to be scheduled until January, we haven't sent out the official notification, but we'll check to make sure, since it probably should have been included in the notification that went out with the FREP notification.
Yeah, because just from just a tribal perspective, that's 2 hours or 2 months of organizing activity, intertribal organizing activity, and possibilities that may have now been put on.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. We'll take care of it.
Sure. Bye.
Okay, and that ends our public comment period. Next item on our agenda is our staff reports, and just a reminder for the board that the staff that wrote each of the reports are here to answer any questions that you may have, but we're not going to have them come up and present what they have provided in written format for you. Do we have any questions from any board members on the written staff reports that were provided in your packet? Tom?
I don't actually have a question. I just wanted to comment on the final report. It's called 10 Years of Federal Funding in Support of Implementing Adaptive Management that Jim submitted. I really enjoyed reading that, actually. I thought it was a great summary, and I think it's a good primer for board members. And, you know, so many of us have worked with this, but new board members in particular, I think, would benefit from having that part of their orientation pack. So thanks for doing that.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion for the orientation. I also found that very, very well written and interesting to find out $25 million worth of PAC SURF money, federal money for staff recovery, has been spent on forced practices of the adaptive management program. So, yeah, certainly well worth pointing out. Other questions from other board members on staff reports? Okay. Thank you, staff. Obviously, your reports are well written and there are no questions. We'll get ourselves back on our agenda timeline here. The next item on our agenda is our, and thank you, DNR staff, that are now exiting the room. They were here to answer questions. The next item on our agenda is an update on the forest biomass group that I'm leading for DNR. And there are handouts on the side, and they were in the packet for all the board members. Essentially, what I wanted to do is just to point out that we have a very defined work plan. At the last meeting, I described the status of the biomass work group. I mentioned that we had a charter and that we had a timeline for evaluating the existing rules and how we are looking at whether those rules now with forest biomass as a forest practice activity are still sufficient, given that there could be a potential for an increase of biomass harvest activities. So I wanted to just update the group that we have been working through the different sections of the rule. It's a fairly rigorous process. We've had a number of field trips already, and I appreciate Norm and other forest landowners and operators that have allowed us to go on your property and share your experiences with how biomass harvests occur, the type of equipment's used. I know for myself, it's been highly educational, and I think for the members of the group as well. It's been a very collaborative process. I think it's been very well received. Everybody's heartily engaged, and so we're having a robust discussion, and it's been very collaborative. So I don't really want to spend a whole lot of time on it. There is, in your packet, as I mentioned, the charter, and followed by the work plan, which we are aggressively trying to stick to. It's a very quick timeline with potential for a recommendation or a report back to the board next May. Any questions on that? Yes, Norm.
Bridget, not a question, but just a comment that if there are board members that would like to see biomass harvesting in operation, I think that the majority of it's actually happening up on the North Olympic Peninsula, a lot of it on our lands and on other landowners in that area, which is a long ways away from Olympia, where many of you live and work. But I still will welcome you individually or as a group, if that's the way that you wish to come, just let me know. I'd be happy to take you out and show you what we showed the biomass work group. Maybe a slightly different locations depending on what's going on, but certainly the work, I'd be glad to make that available to any of you that would like to come out and see it.
Thank you, Norm. I personally have found it very helpful, so I would encourage anybody who has the desire to take Norm up on his offer. So. Any other questions on the biomass process? I guess one other piece I should mention is that in legislation that was passed last session, there is a requirement for DNR to update the legislature on our process. So we'll be including the same materials that were shared with the board today, the charter and the work plan in that report to the legislature. As part of other biomass legislation, there was an add-on that requested updates from the board process as to how the board was addressing biomass harvest. So we'll be providing the work plan and a little bit of text about where we are in that update, and a copy of that will be shared with the board as well. Okay. All right, moving along on our agenda. The next topic is a presentation by Craig Partridge at DNR regarding the Community Forest Trust Bill. Tom, I think you asked for this last time, and Craig is here to give us a brief presentation on what the Community Forest Trust is, and I'll take it away, Craig.
Thank you. And this is a response to.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Craig Partridge, policy director.
Yeah.
This is a kind of high-level overview of this legislation. It passed last session in Gross Substitute House Bill 1421. It passed with quite a bit of support in both houses. And the concept is really pretty simple. This, the Community Forest Trust, is one more tool among all the different tools we have to address the problem of working forest lands converting to non-forest uses. So this is one more approach to that. The focus of the Community Forest Trust is on state trust land or private forest lands with high community conservation significance. And I'm not going to try to define that right now, but I'd be very open to questions that the board may have. It's actually a fairly complex piece of legislation that I'm going to be presenting in a fairly simple way because the underlying ideas are fairly simple. The mechanism that would be used is fee acquisition of the state trust lands or private lands using funding coming from the state legislature combined with funding coming from the local community. And there are some specific guidance in the legislation about how the combinations of funding. But there's a requirement that the local community basically express support and buy-in through contributing to the acquisition funds. The management of the lands then, once acquired, would be by DNR. But there would be a strong community involvement through an advisory committee. And the management would be aimed primarily at community conservation benefits, whatever those benefits were that merited the acquisition in the first place, but also including revenue production for self-sufficiency. So in other words, and this could include what I would call conservation-oriented commercial forestry and other revenue-producing activities sufficient to pay for management itself, to pay for any capital investments in conservation-oriented benefits, maybe recreation facilities or that sort of thing, and to make some contributions toward repayment of acquisition costs to the extent that that was feasible. But the main point being a kind of a self-sufficient conservation ownership that wouldn't be a draw on the general fund, for example, for management itself. And where we're at right now is there is quite a list of to-dos in the bill to get this program up and running. There's no appropriation. We can't use other trust monies, for example, on this program. And so we are focusing on outreach to potential community partners to generally assess the interest across the state in this. We're getting quite a bit of interest, and we're going to continue to do that. There are ways that we think we can bootstrap into setting up the program and getting it going, and we will proceed to that after we've assessed the breadth of community interest. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about it. Paul.
I understand that you're still in startup phase, but do you have candidate properties or have any communities come forward and said we're interested in utilizing this program once you're ready?
Yeah, there were communities that were coming forward during the session, and there have been communities that have come forward, not necessarily in a relatively exploratory way. Hey, we heard about this community forest. Hey, we've got some land, you know, private land or trust land in our watershed that may be of interest. Can we talk about just whether the Community Forest Trust might be an applicable concept? I would say the most mature discussion has been happening in East Jefferson County, starting from before the legislation was passed. But we've had actually interest from around the state. And I would say most of it in a pretty exploratory stage. Other questions?
Is there a minimum community participation that's required, like 20%?
You mean financial?
Financial, yeah.
So what the legislation says is that the local community, and it doesn't define who that local community is, that could include local government or other private or NGO entities, needs to contribute 50% of the non-timber value of the property. Most of these properties will have a pretty healthy proportion of non-timber real estate value along with the timber value. And it's that non-timber value that the local community would be required to pay 50% of in order to purchase the fee ownership from the private or trust owner.
And they potentially can get money back through the forced activities.
That potential is certainly there, explicit in the legislation. What's also explicit in the legislation, of course, is the conservation-oriented nature. So if either the state or the local community expected to get the full value of the acquisition, that, of course, that value would be predicated on full development of the property. So yeah. Obviously, that a full compensation wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Yes, Norm.
Is the Board of Natural Resources the body that would approve a purchase then?
Yes. Yes, everything would have to come to the board. And the board, there's also provisions in the bill if things just aren't working out at any stage of the game. There's also the opportunity to off-ramp these properties back to the private sector or back to the trust.
Good questions. Thank you, Greg. I would just maybe add that there is not a nexus with this program with the Forest Practices Board. It's not a regulatory program, but this was an area of interest that board members had requested last time, so that was the focus for today.
In my mind, probably the main interest would be in the type of forestry that might be practiced on these lands and how that would interact with the regulatory program, because obviously any kind of forest practices on these lands would be required to get forest practice permits.
Great, thank you for joining us today. The next item on our agenda is the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team update. We have Lauren Burns and Andy Hayes from DNR here today. Please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Moran and members of the board. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Andy Hayes. I'm a policy specialist with DNR's policy office. And sitting next to me is Lauren Burns, who is our new Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team Coordinator. This is our first time in front of this body, and we appreciate the opportunity. Since the chair last reported to you in August, the implementation team has met twice, and we have two more meetings planned in December and January. I'd like to report on their progress. We're busy at the moment working on three important elements of the work plan. The first is that we've met with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Spotted Owl Recovery Plan modeling team to discuss the use of their analytical tools. We've selected technical team members and begun scoping their process. And third, we've reinvested our efforts to identify an east side pilot project. So I'd like to start by just talking briefly about our work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In August, Brian Woodbridge, who's the recovery planning modeling lead for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, presented to the implementation team. He gave a high-level presentation of the structure and the capabilities of the modeling tools that they have developed to examine landscape level spotted owl habitat dynamics associated with the recovery plan. The team had initial discussion with Mr. Woodbridge about the technical team, how the technical team may use those modeling tools to look at spatial and temporal allocations of conservation efforts on non-federal lands, as is the charge of the implementation team. He answered some initial questions about the capabilities of their models and their ability to assist in some targeted analysis the team may wish to conduct. The implementation team will work with the newly identified technical team, which we'll tell you about in a moment, in December to define some key questions that we can cooperate with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service team to help answer. We have another meeting with Mr. Woodbridge in January to further discuss our cooperation. So Lauren would like to update you on our efforts to convene the technical team.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board. For the record, my name is Lauren Burns, and I'm with DNR and the newly appointed coordinator of the Northern Spotted Owl implementation team. This morning, I'll tell you about the technical team update, where we are now and where we're going. After an extensive and collaborative process, we're pleased to announce that we're finalizing our technical team membership, and a technical team of 8 people will be formed, consisting of 6 biologists and 2 environmental economists, and with particular expertise in of northern spotted owls in Washington State, as well as for the economists, expertise in market and quasi-market transactions of ecosystem services. So biologist membership includes 2 federal representatives. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is in progress, but it'll likely be Carl Halutka. For Forest Service, it'll be Elaine Ryback. For our state representative, it'll be Joe Buchanan of WDFW. For our industry representative, it'll be Tony Melchers of Weyerhaeuser. Our tribe's representative is still in progress, but it will likely be Gina King of the Yakima Nation Wildlife Program. And for our conservation representative, it will be Carl Whitaker of the Washington Forest Law Center. And the 2 economists that have agreed to participate on the team are Sarah Cruz and James Pittman. Now, we were surprised to find that there were additional economists that were willing to participate on the team. So further discussions will have to happen between the committee or between the team and the technical team to decide if we would like to have additional economists on that team helping us. So as Andy had mentioned, we have a tentatively scheduled meeting in December between the NSOIT and the NSOIT technical team to discuss specific questions we would like them to answer and to collaboratively develop a reasonable set of goals and expectations, including timelines and deliverables. This will also be followed by a tentative meeting in January with Brian Woodbridge to discuss how his modeling effort can assist our technical team process. And a general estimate as to how long we're expecting this to take, the process will likely continue through winter and into spring, but again, that depends on our process in December of developing the analytical questions collaboratively with the technical team. On that, I would like to, the entire team would like to express our sincere and genuine appreciation for the technical team members to be volunteering their time and expertise to this really critical work. It's central to helping our team move forward, and as well as the overarching Northern Spotted Owl issue in Washington. So with that, I'll hand the mic back to Andy.
So the last element that we wanted to update you on was our work on an Eastside pilot project. As you may remember, initial attempts to develop both West Side and East Side pilot projects in 2010 were unsuccessful, predominantly due to funding issues. And per the work plan, the implementation team is redoubling its effort at the moment to develop pilot projects to demonstrate thinning in northern spotted owl habitat by pursuing an East Side project. The background on this, you may remember that this project was the subject of a pilot rule passed by the board in February 2010 to take place on Longview Timberlands. The focus of the pilot is developing prescriptions for thinning in overstocked owl habitat with the goal of restoring habitat quality and improving forest health. The pilot identified about 1,200 acres in the Entiat spotted owl emphasis area within which thinning could occur on about half of that, about 640 acres. Under the pilot, existing habitat can be treated as long as it remains habitat after the treatment. So the status is that the team has not identified where the pilot project will be within the planning area. We're still in the planning stages of figuring out if we can treat stands so that they'll remain habitat, and then secondly, you know, can we make them economical? And so we're working with Longview Timber on how to move forward at this time. One critical piece of this is funding. We have done some initial work to identify possible grant opportunities, such as Section 6, but they will not become available until sometime in late 2012. And so, in the meantime, we're going to use this time to focus our efforts on working with Longview Timber to identify, you know, how this might happen, where, convening a project team to assist with planning, writing prescriptions for thinning, and developing a reliable cost estimate that will be needed to apply for funding to actually undertake these activities. So we're really just in the planning stage of this project, but we'll be coming back to you with more information as it becomes available. Just one last note, I'd like to note that we received a grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Fort NSO, or North Spotted Owl, a recovery plan implementation. This will provide the team with a modest but very significant funding for an additional staff member, and she's sitting right next to me here. Lauren was previously working as a volunteer intern. We're very pleased to have her working part-time now for the department. And I think this will allow the implementation team to continue to make progress forward, which is, had been an issue in the past, so we're glad to have Lauren on board. And Lauren and I will continue working in earnest on this project. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Just a quick comment and question then. I just wanted to thank both of you and also DNR in general for taking the time to apply for that grant. And I think having a dedicated, well, both of you, it sounds like we'll continue to work on it, but especially having Lauren focus on this exclusively is, I think that is a really positive sign. And Lauren, I just had a question. You mentioned the meeting that's going to be in mid-December. Was that going to be between both the technical team and the NSOIT?
Yes, that would be a joint meeting with NSOIT and the tech team.
And you said that hopefully part of the time will be spent just developing a timeline for both groups and kind of solidifying goals and targets.
Exactly.
Okay, great.
Other questions? Yes, Paul.
This might be a more of a question for you than it is for the two of you, but depending on who's most up to date, can you guys talk a little bit about the interaction between the timeline of our technical team and the Fish and Wildlife Service habitat and other activities that you're undertaking right now?
Sure, I'll start, and then if there are details that I get wrong, you guys interrupt me. So my understanding is that the draft critical habitat by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will now be out January 17th, I believe. And so that was delayed by 2 months. It was originally supposed to be out any time now. And by court agreement, that has now been postponed until mid-January. So our hope was that we would get our technical team formed, which we've now completed, and that the joint meeting in December would allow us time to identify really what those questions are that we want to ask the technical team. As many of you maybe have learned over the time, I certainly have, when a group of policy folks sit around and write technical questions and then hand them off to a technical team, they usually look at them and say, that's fine, but I really can't answer this, or my answer will be, it depends. So we want to engage the tech team in the formulation of those questions so that they are clear enough to provide an answer with clarity within a defined period of time. So regarding the timeline with the Fish and Wildlife Service, my hope is that our team will be up and formed by the time the draft critical habitat comes out. And at that point, then the staff from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will be available to participate in our team. So they're sort of busy now, but we're using that time to get ourselves organized. When their critical habitat comes out, then that'll be open for public comment for some period of time. They can then re-engage with us. That will then provide us an opportunity in the implementation team to address at least the question that the board asked of the implementation team, which is to identify the spatial and temporal extent of non-federal lands in Washington that can contribute to the recovery of spotted owl. So that's the key question, but we're trying to figure out exactly how to tease that out. So my hope from a timeline is that early next year, the tech team will be working in conjunction with the federal modeling team, and that maybe by spring they'll have an opportunity to give us some preliminary answers as to how our efforts could align from the implementation team's work. So I see really information not really being back to this board until likely between our February and May meetings, possibly some early work in February to at least, we could certainly have the staff come back and report where we are and maybe a process timeline that we've agreed to, but I really don't see information to respond to or engage with at the board level until really after the beginning of the year. If that answers your question.
It does, thank you.
One piece I wanted to add on the pilot project, that was really something that was a high priority, and I think this board might remember that there was a, went through the pilot rulemaking, et cetera. We're in a bit of a catch-22 in that, because in certain cases, it's a lot like our CEMA projects, where we need to have a plan in place to apply for grant funding to enact the plan, but yet developing the plan also takes resources. So we need to convene biologists and foresters, et cetera, to go out on the landscape and look at what the thinning prescriptions on the landscape should be, such that they retain the habitat definitions, but yet that takes resources as well. So we're trying to figure out how can we, with limited or no resources, how can we get a plan in place, or do we need to get additional funding to try to get the plan developed so that we have something that we can compete for with grant funding. So I just wanted to put a little more clarity onto that. We are fortunate that we've had a lot of that we've had volunteers willing to participate on our technical team, but we've asked them a different question, not how to lay out a sale to retain habitat. So just wanted to put a little finer point on that, because that's an area that I know I have great interest in, seeing something actually happen on the landscape rather than us talking about it. And we even contemplated in our last meeting that we would possibly, in lieu of going out and looking at a particular landscape, possibly design what would be expected prescriptions that could occur on any landscape in a pilot nature, and but to try to at least move the marble on what those prescriptions might be. So the team is contemplating how to move ahead so we can get some pilot work going, but we have a bit of a hurdle to overcome at this point on that. Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, and Lauren, it's great to have you on staff. Okay. Sorry, that was too easy. Okay. Next item on our agenda is an update on the Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group. Mark Engel. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. For the record, I'm Mark Engel. I'm the Forest Practices ADM for Policy and Services. In the rule establishing the Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group, we're required to give an annual report to the board in November of each year. This group is, when called, this group evaluates the need based on available habitat to maintain northern spotted owl site centers. The intent of this report is to help the board determine whether this group continues to be needed. In the last year, there have been no northern spotted owl surveys submitted for review by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So the group was not convened. So are there any questions?
Is everybody familiar with what Mark's referring to? Okay. So we have an advisory group that would evaluate what happens if surveys are submitted on a path towards decertification, and that has not occurred. So we have an obligation through rule to notify the board every year as to how that's proceeding. Marcus does such that. Okay, thank you. Okay, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, but I would like to take our break now and reconvene at 10:25.